It's easy today to, with all the changes going on, to walk onto the wrong airplane, heading the wrong place, or walk into the wrong room. I heard several weeks ago about a fellow that went to a convention, took off, and got all the way down. Somewhere was on the East Coast, found out when he got down there that it had been canceled, and he was never notified. So he flew all the way down there for nothing. So if you flew into the room for finances, you're in the right room. Let's have a word of prayer, and we'll get started. Lord, we thank you for the fact that you give us so much. We thank you for the resources, the material, the spiritual, emotional resources that you give. And it really is the desire of each one of us as your children to be good stewards of everything that you place in our hands. And we would ask this morning that you would help us toward that end through the things that we do here today, that we would become more knowledgeable and have a better grasp of what it means to be a steward of what you have given. In Jesus' name, amen. All of you have a pink sheet? You should have gotten a pink sheet. Does anyone not have one? Okay. You might have some other paper, but Lord willing, we're going to follow this right down the line. I don't think you could find, by the way, my name is Dave Kraft. I work here at Glen Eyrie. I kind of serve a double role. I'm the assistant manager for Glen Eyrie, and I'm also the executive administrator, so they keep me pretty busy. One of my responsibilities is to oversee the budget here and make sure that we do everything with black ink and not red ink. Anyone can identify with that at home and in your personal finances? I don't think you could find a subject more volatile and more vital than this whole subject of finances. You can hardly pick up a paper today and read about our government in some aspect that the whole subject of finances comes in. Ideas and how to get rid of the deficit and what to do about this and that and how to get everything under control. So it's a big issue in the government. It's a big issue in the schools. We read just yesterday in our papers right here in Colorado Springs that a school that had been open for 102 years closed its doors due to finances. The paper said that it had been running in a deficit position for the last 10 years. And finally, they just couldn't do it any longer. So today and yesterday, the paper is just filled with articles about this school. 102 years. And finally, the doors bang shut because of finances. It's a big problem in marriage. If you were to just take statistics about why marriages go on the rocks or why they have problems, I believe that you'll always find the subject of finances and money in the top three or four items. It always comes in there. Probably as husband and wife, we spend more time discussing finances than maybe any other one thing. Maybe the kids sometimes, but it seems like every day you get into the subject of finances and who's going to do what with the money and how are we going to do this and how are we going to do that. I ran across this recently. And it's true. These four guys are responsible for a lot of broken marriages. Obviously, those are the gentlemen that appear on the various $5, $10, $20 bills, so forth. Now, just to get us loosened up, it's always good just to look through the eyes of humor at some of the financial problems that we face. Maybe some of you can identify with this. I must have checked these accounts a dozen times, but I'll be darned if I can figure out what I did wrong. And then the husband asked, well, what's the problem? Well, according to my calculations, I spent less than you earned last month. As if to say that, let me see if we can focus that a little better. As if to say that that's something wrong. The normal thing is that I spend more than you earn. And so something went wrong this month. I can't figure it out. I spent less. Then many of you, I'm sure, appreciate the Lockhorns. Are you feeling all right? It isn't like you to come home before you run out of money. Then the one on the right over here. There must be an easier way to save money than by doing without things. Well, if there's an easier way, has anyone here ever found it? the government hasn't figured it out yet that the way to save money is to cut down on your expenditures. I think they know it. It's just that they can't agree on what they're going to cut down on. And it's a never-ending battle. Now, how about this one over here? Okay, Trudy, pick one. Let's see what bill we pay this month. Blindfolded into the fishbowl to pull one out and kind of figure out which one we're going to take care of. But I think this is my favorite right here. How do I know where the money goes? You think I keep track? Well, that's the problem, isn't it? We don't know where the money's going sometimes because nobody is keeping track. I read recently of a man who was going out visiting families and homes. And could we have you sit over on this side? Is that okay? I want to have you all right here in front of me. How you doing, Carl? He was going around taking these interviews, talking to families about their spending habits just to see if he could spot any trends. So he knocked on the door of this one house and he said, well, I'd like to just ask you how you allocate your funds each month. I mean, how much do you spend on food? How much do you spend on the house and the mortgage and utilities, on clothes and so forth and so on? So the guy thought for a minute. He says, well, he said, we spend about 60% of what comes in on the house, the utilities, everything to do with the house. He said, then we spend 40% on food and miscellaneous and things like that, and then 20% on everything else. And the guy thought for a minute. He said, but sir, he said, that's 120%. He said, yeah, I know, and it gets worse every year. Well, that's another one of the problems. There was a newspaper columnist a few years ago that you've heard the story of the have and the have-nots. Well, he said there are basically three groups of people in the world. There are the haves, the have-nots, and the have-not-paid for what they haves. And the trend seems to be in our country that more and more people are falling into that third category, the have-not-paid for what they haves. Well, let's start out with number one on your outline, false ideas regarding money. Everything we've said thus far was by way of introduction. It is a serious subject. We laugh at it sometimes, but probably more times than not, we cry over it. False ideas regarding money. We have three. Number one, false idea is that money is the root of all evil. Now that almost sounds like a Bible verse. But what's wrong with it? Money is the root of all evil. The love. Okay. 1 Timothy 6:10, if you want to take your Bibles and just turn there. First Timothy 6:10, and in the NIV it says, the love of money is the root of all evil, not money in and of itself. I don't know anywhere in the Bible where money itself is condemned or criticized in any sense. There are problems associated with money, but money in itself is not the problem. Let me tell you three things that are the problem. We're still on point A under one there, false ideas. There are three problems that are three areas that cause the problems. One is greed. Two is preoccupation. And three is the misuse of finances or money. So having it or not having it is not really the problem. It's greed, preoccupation, and misuse. I was reading an article just yesterday, and somebody made an interesting statement about the fact that we all have greed glands. Some, you know, some little thing somewhere in our body that secretes small portions of greed juice or something along those lines that makes us greedy. I don't think it's true, of course, but it captured an interesting picture. You know, that there's a gland somewhere in your body that secretes all this greed, and that's the reason that we become greedy easily. B, under number one, there is a correlation between wealth, happiness, and success. We are told this a lot in our society, that the happy people, the successful people, The well-adjusted people, the really joyful people, are the ones that have money and lots of it. And it's just a lie. You and I both know many situations where people had more than they knew what to do with, but there was really no happiness or genuine satisfaction in life. There isn't really any direct correlation between wealth, happiness, and the amount of money that you have. Someone has said that the sin of the poor is envy, and the sin of the rich is greed. So even those that don't have it can create problems for themselves in the area of envy or looking jealously at people who do have it. You might have heard of the statement that John Rockefeller responded with when he was asked, how much money does it take to make a man happy? His response was, just a little bit more. And there you have the whole essence of greed. Luke 12:15, we know the story of the man who had so much that he had to tear down all of his barns and build bigger barns to store everything in. Let me just turn there for a moment. Luke 12:15. Then he said to them, watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of the things that he or she possesses. Yet we're getting different signals from the media, from some Christian circles, that that's not true. That a man's life does consist of the abundance of the things which he possesses. And that's why we're constantly encouraged to possess more and more and more, at a price, of course. So there is no direct correlation between happiness, success, all the other adjectives that we might want to put in there, and the idea of having lots of money. Point C. The point here that we're going to make is that it's wrong to have lots of money. You might have heard this, that somehow it's just not right that one person should have so much. I would contend that the Bible neither teaches that it's wrong to have it. 1 Timothy 6:17 is one of the most interesting verses that I know on that subject. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 17. By the way, there are several key chapters in the Bible on the whole subject of money, and 1 Timothy 6 is one of these. If you want to do some Bible study on the subject of finances, spend some time in 1 Timothy chapter 6. It's loaded with key principles, theology about money, practical suggestions on what to do and what not to do. Verse 17, on the point of it's wrong to have lots of money. Paul is writing to Timothy and he says in verse 17, command those who are rich in this present world to give it all away. Is that what it says? No, it doesn't, does it? Command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. What else is he told to tell those who are rich? Command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, to be generous, willing to share. In this way they will lay up treasures for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age, so that they may take hold of the life that is truly life. Nowhere in that passage commands to those that have a lot of it does it say get rid of it. That talks about being generous. So the key thing is how to be a steward of it, not to think that there's something wrong with having it. It's interesting to note that many of the godliest men in the Old Testament were very wealthy men. Now let me tell you what I think another set of problems are. And we're still under point C. You have 1, 2, 3, 4 there. Number one under C, the key question to ask ourselves is not how much we have, but here are the three questions. Number four is a little different matter, but the first three there under point C, the questions to ask is, the method you use to get it, the motive as to why you got it, and the manner in which you use it. Those to me are vital, vital questions. The method you use to get it, the motive as to why you got it, that's number two, and number three, the manner in how you use it. These relate, of course, back to our other three points, that the big problem is greed, preoccupation, and misuse. So let's talk for a couple of moments related to why you get it. What is it that motivates us to want to have money and security and in the bank and, you know, everything that we associate with it? This is number four. We're still under C there. We're going to break this one down into four different or six different things. Okay, why do people accumulate wealth? Number A, under four there, they're advised to do so. There are many people today that will basically contract themselves out to you. They're called financial planners. They will advise you what to do with your money. They will tell you invest in this and invest in that and capitalize on it and multiply it and so forth and so on. So a lot of people simply find themselves accumulating wealth because they were advised to do so. Where to put it and how to make it work and so forth and so on. B, under four, self-esteem. We attach a lot of self-esteem or self-worth or security to our financial status. That's one of the big lies in this society. If you dress a certain way, if you look a certain way, it gives you a sense of self-esteem. Now, maybe that in itself is not a problem. But if we have to accumulate a certain amount to make us feel good, then the thing is we're looking to something other than God for our self-worth. And that it can be a very, very big hole in the ground to fall into. A very captivating verse on this subject that I ran across recently is in the book of Job, if you want to turn there. Job chapter 31. Job 31 and verse 24. Where he says, if I have put my trust in gold, or said to pure gold, you are my security. Then he goes on and elaborates on this thought and points out at the end of the passage that he would be making a big mistake. But as I thought about this, I thought there couldn't be anything probably more characteristic of the society and the age in which we live in that particular verse. Putting my trust in gold and saying to gold, you are my security. For lack of a better thing, I like to think of it as the Scrooge McDuck syndrome. Any of you grow up reading Scrooge McDuck and Uncle Donald Duck and his three nephews? What do you remember about Uncle Scrooge? What comes to your mind? What did he spend his time doing? Okay, he counted it. What else did he do with it? He played with it. He swam in it. And what was he forever trying to do to preserve it? There were a certain bunch of boys that were always trying to get their hands on his money. Remember who they were? The Beagle Boys, right, with their little black masks. And so all the comic strips went out to the fact that Scrooge had so much money, and he'd had this diving board. He would jump up and down on his diving board and jump in the money bin, and then he was always thinking of ingenious ways to fight off the Beagle Boys from getting their hands on his money. And we laugh and chuckle over that. But subconsciously, those kinds of things can creep into our minds, and we find ourselves sometimes with the wrong motives pursuing wealth because we think it's going to give us what we want in life. So self-esteem. Number C, under four, the envy of other people. The envy of other people. Maybe you have a brother or a cousin, or maybe your father was very wealthy, so you feel that you have to achieve what your dad did, or what your uncle did, or what your brother did, or your sister. You have to become financially well off like they were in order to prove something to somebody that you are really capable, successful. D, the pure and simple love of money causes some people to pursue it. We just recently went through this thing with the insiders trading. We're not through with it yet. There was another article even this morning where they've arrested or on the track of a few more people And the whole thing behind that deal is just pure and simple greed. In fact, I read an article in Newsweek by Mr. Boesky that he talked to some graduating students at Stanford University, and the whole purpose of his talk was to defend the idea of greed, that greed was okay, it's all right, it's perfectly permissible to be greedy. Interesting. Now, and the interesting thing about it was when he got to that point in his address where he talked about this, he got an ovation from the students at Stanford. Now, years ago, if you asked anybody about greed, they would have thought of it in the connection of being something that wasn't good. Can you imagine somebody standing up today and talking about greed and having people applaud you? Something interesting is going on in the United States. So love of money. Ecclesiastes. Chapter 5 and verse 10 talks about this love of money. And it says, whoever loves money, it's almost a good verse for our friend Rockefeller, whoever loves money never has money enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. Isn't that interesting? So if you get to the place where you love wealth and money and possessions, now there's a difference between loving it and utilizing it and being grateful for it and thankful. When you love it, it becomes an obsession. And it says very simply here that the person who does that, who makes it as his goal, his passion in life to become wealthy, materially prosperous, that he will never really be satisfied. For the simple reason that we pointed out earlier what Rockefeller said, that it always takes just a little bit more. Add a few more zeros onto it. Whoever loves money never has money enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. E, for E, the game of it. It's a game. Playing the stock market, watching the trends go up and down and figuring out where it's like, for some people get the enjoyment of playing checkers and moving the men around on the board. Some people get a bang out of shifting things around and just watching what's going to happen with the market and with everything that they've got cooking. I have a brother who's fairly well off and he has money in the market. The very first thing he does every morning when he opens his eyes is picks up the Wall Street Journal and turns to the financial section to find out what happened while he was asleep to his treasures and everything that he has. The game of it. The last one, F, really, in my thinking, is the only legitimate reason among the bunch. And that is because it's a spiritual gift. God has given certain people the gift of being able to make money and lots of it. They have a responsibility, obviously, with this gift. But it comes very easy to them. Seems like no matter what they do, things just seem to keep happening. I often thought that some people got the gift of turning things into gold. I got the gift of turning it into mud. When I touch things and try to make a go, it seems like it goes the other way around. So I need a lot of help in that area. But certain people just seem to make the right choices. They have an intuitive sense of what to do in business and so forth. And maybe you know some people like that. Deuteronomy chapter 8, verse 18 speaks to this issue. Chapter 8, verse 18 says, but remember the Lord your God, for it is He. It is He who gives you the ability to produce wealth. It's a gift that God has given. The ability to produce wealth. A spiritual gift. So those are some false ideas on what it's all about. That money is not the root of all evil. It's the love of money, greed, preoccupation, and misuse. There isn't a correlation, a direct correlation between how much money you have and how happy you will be. There are poor people who are just elated and joyful. There are those that have millions that are very miserable and go to the extent of committing suicide. It's not wrong to have lots of money. The method and how you got it, the motive as to why you got it, and the manner in which you use it are a lot more vital questions than if you have it or don't have it. And some ideas on why people accumulate wealth. Let's move on to number 2 there. Some key principles. Point A, two roles. we must understand. And that is that God is the owner and we are the stewards of what he has given us. More misery comes from mixing those two up, that somehow I own it. Therefore, I make the decisions. I make the choices. I decide what I'm going to do. Now, if you were a steward of what someone else owned, it would be logical that you would go to the person who owned it and ask, what would you like to have me do with that which you own? And it's naturally logical to ask the same question of God. Lord, how would you have me invest? How would you have me spend? What would you have me do with what you've given me? In simple words, to pray and ask the owner what we should do with what he's given. You have some passages of Scripture there on the right-hand side. We won't look at them. 1 Corinthians 4, 7, Psalm 24, 1, Matthew 25. That speaks to this issue of the fact that God is the owner. I ran across another one that you might want to add to the list just in my Bible reading the other day. I'm reading through Chronicles. And 1 Chronicles chapter 29, it's already down there. It's down a little bit further. 1 Chronicles 29:14. You'll see it down across from point 3. But let me read that while I've got it here. It says, "But who am I and who are my people that we should be able to give as generously as this? Everything comes from you. And we have given you only what comes from your hand." And then further down in verse 16 it says, "For your holy name, it comes from your hand, and all of it belongs to you." And I wrote down in the margin of my Bible over here when I was praying over this, God is both the origin and the owner of material blessings. God is both the origin and the owner of material blessings. It comes from him and it belongs to him. So there are these two roles, that God is the owner, I am the steward. Number B, under point two, three levels. So there are three spending levels. I've entitled them, you've heard of the good, bad, and the ugly. Well, this is the dumb, good, and the excellent. The good is that your expenditures, E stands for expenditures, and I stands for income, that your expenditures and income are equal. That's a good situation to be in, but it's not the best. The best would be over here on the right, that your income exceeds your expenditures on a consistent basis. In this case, we've use an illustration, say that you spend that you earn $100 more than you spend, say a month or a week, whatever the case might be. The dumb situation, of course, is that your expenditures exceed your income by $50 a month. It's amazing how fast you can get into debt with just a little bit of variance here, maybe just $10, $15, $20 a month, that you're just a little bit each month exceeding your income, and then over a period of time with 21% interest, it really starts to snowball on you, and some catastrophic things can happen. So there are three spending levels. And you'll notice on your sheet there it says off to the right that we need to decide. We need to decide which of these spending levels are we going to operate at. Are we going to try to keep it even? Are we going to spend slowly on the deficit side of things? Or are we going to try to conserve and have our income exceeding our expenditures slightly or more, whatever we decide? Point C, that there are three time periods. We'll come back to this orange sheet in a couple of minutes. Point C, there are three time periods. Somebody has humorously referred to them as the learning years, the earning years, and the yearning years. The learning years, of course, is during your education when you are getting prepared for a vocation. The earning years are those years when you actually have an income. And the yearning years are when you're at the other end of the line yearning for things that you don't have because you blew it maybe in the other two phases. And we need to get prepared. During the learning years, the point is to get prepared for the earning years. Now, where a lot of people make mistakes is during those earning years, they don't watch it very carefully. They might get themselves into a deficit situation, or they never save or plan in any way, shape, or form for the future. So when they get down to the end, there really isn't anything there, and they find themselves really in a tough spot. Large portions of our society find themselves in that situation, where they are dependent on children or the welfare program or something else in order to get through, because they didn't think ahead during the earning years. And we're going to talk about that as we move on here. Number D, under two, some key principles. There are three uses of our resources, namely sharing, saving, and spending. Now you can pull out that orange sheet again. Let me explain this, and then we will spend the remainder of our time going into those three areas. And then we're at the tail, in probably the last 15 or 20 minutes, we're going to give you an opportunity to ask questions and interact. But follow this closely. This is very, very important. What you're trying to accomplish, both look at your orange sheet and then kind of glance up here at the same time, is you're trying to decrease your expenditures and increase your income, or a combination thereof. It's really quite simple when you think of our enormous deficit. We have people there that have advanced degrees in economics, but there really is only two things you can do, isn't there? You either have to lower your expenditures or increase your income. The whole problem, of course, is they can't seem to get an agreement about what they're going to raise and what they're going to lower. Hopefully, it will be a little easier for you in your own personal finances, husband, wife, and children, to figure that out. So the goal is to keep the level of expenditures below the level of income. That's really what you're shooting for in your own financial planning, to keep the level of expenditures below the level of income. Now, here's a couple of ways over here that you can do that. You can increase your income, for instance, by liquidating assets, selling things, turning it into money so that your income goes up. Another way, of course, is to increase your salary or investments. There are a number of ways to create more. Maybe some of you have been to financial seminars, and the thing that you learn from some of these is there are a lot more ways of increasing income than most of us realize. Some of us really don't understand the taxes and how to make them work and to make sure that we have all of the proper deductions. So you need to be working both ends of the fence all the time. Try to hold the expenditures down. Try it as much as possible through wise choices and planning to get your increase to go up. Now, here's what you're trying to accomplish. By lowering this one here, getting your spending down, it means that you can funnel more over to sharing and more over to saving. Now, follow this along with me. I'm going to read through these 5 points at the bottom here. The first step is to find out if you're dumb, good, or excellent. Which category do you find yourself operating in? That should be fairly easy for you to figure out. Or you find yourself just kind of deficit spending, or you keep things pretty even, or do you have that cushion? Maybe you want to increase it. So find out if you're good, dumb, or excellent by getting an accurate reading on your expenditures and your income. One way to do this, of course, is with a budget. Do everything possible to get yourself into the excellent category by decreasing expenditures and increasing income. 3, work up a monthly budget so as to keep expenditures under control. 4, use credit cards for credit and not for debt. There's a real difference. Using it for credit means you use the card, but you know you have the money in the bank, so when the thing comes from the MasterCard or the Visa card, whatever it is you've got, you just basically write a check, take it out of your bank, and pay it. That's using it for credit. Using it for debt means you use it when you don't have the money in the bank. And when it comes, you can't pay it. So you pay $10 or $20, and everyone back at Visa headquarters is smiling and rubbing their hands because they know they've got you. So once you start in that routine of paying $10 or $20 a month, then in comes the 21%, and that's when the whole thing starts to snowball. And we'll talk more about that a little later. So one of the key ingredients is use the credit cards properly. 5, when income increases, continue to keep your expenditures down. Now, the mistake a lot of people make, watch this now, you're sitting here, this is your income, and your expenditures are down, you're doing very well. And all of a sudden you get a raise, or you get a windfall, or grandmother leaves you some money, and all of a sudden it shoots up. What's the natural tendency when that happens? you shoot up with it. Oh boy, now we can do this, now we can do that. So instead of being able to profit from this gap now that you've got and funnel more into sharing and saving, we tend to spend it. So we go out and buy new things and we turn around and get ourselves in the hole all over again, even though we've got more to work with. It's amazing to talk to somebody, and they are out there, that make $100,000 a year, and you know what? They're broke. You think, how in the world could somebody be broke making $100,000 a year? Very simple. They spend more than $100,000 a year. And they did it just following this simple procedure. Every time this went up. And so they kept going up, not only up, but probably going beyond what they were making, and they worked themselves slowly up. And that's the natural tendency in our culture, is if we have more money, obviously, we should spend it. Is it that obvious? Why not share it? Why not save it, invest it for something else, rather than just spend it? But all of the voices yelling and screaming at you and me constantly over the radio and the television and the newspapers is spend it, spend it, spend it, spend it, spend it. Buy this, buy that. And so we're inundated all the time, and so our natural tendency is to keep moving up the ladder. So number five, when income increases, continue to keep your expenditures down so that you have more that you can funnel into saving and more into sharing. Okay, let's take these categories one at a time and address each of the three of them briefly. We've got three simple S's, and I believe they have to go in this order. The first thing when money comes our way is to share, then to save, and then to spend. One of the problems is, of course, we reverse the order. We spend first, and if we have anything left over, we will give. And after we give, if there's anything left over, we'll save. The problem is that after we spend, generally, there isn't anything left over, so we neither give or save. And there are many Christians that don't give at all, maybe a couple of dollars on a Sunday. You know, if the Christians around the country were to tithe even 5%, of what they made, straight across the board, every believer who sat in a church today, the church would have so much money, it would have problems figuring out how to invest it. But it's a very small minority who give even close to that. Vast numbers of Christians, been Christians for years, will kick in a dollar, $2, maybe five, if they're especially in a generous mood, and yet they're taking anywhere from $1,500 to $35,000, $4,000 a month home in their pockets and giving $5, $6 a week. So first is the sharing. Now you've got some verses over there, Proverbs 3, 9 and 10, 2 Corinthians 9, 6 to 8, 1 Chronicles 29, 14 that we already shared. I'm not going to look up these verses. I'll have you pursue it and look them up on your own and see what they have to say. But let me share with you just a personal testimony. I'm a missionary with the Navigators, which means that we don't have any set salary. So for 18 years, going on 19 years now, I don't have a guaranteed salary. That would scare some people half to death to start with. Some of you that are salespeople, so forth, you're on a commission, you know what that's like, that you don't know. You don't have any guarantee 1 month to the next, especially if you're 100% commission with no base figure to work from. So we don't know from month to month exactly what's going to happen. But when we started off, when we got married 18 years ago, we decided that we would put the Lord first in this area. And so what we've been doing all these years is when we get any money, the first thing we do is take it right off the top and put it over to the side. I can recall months when after we took it off the top, there wasn't anything left to meet all the bills. We actually didn't have enough just for the basic essentials. But God has always been faithful. It came through the mail, or we found it under the door, or I found one time I went or drove a fellow to church, and we didn't have enough in the house to even eat, not for lunch. So my little mind started working and thought, well, we'll go visit a town where we know a lot of people, a church that we used to attend. Maybe somebody will invite us home for lunch. That's the way I was thinking. So we got in the car, Susan and I, and we drove to this town, and we went to the church, and people said, hello, how are you, and so forth. We even drove one fellow home. Pulled up in front of the house, and we saw them starting to sit down at the dining room table through the window on the facing the street. He said goodbye, walked in, walked over, took off his jacket, sat down on the table. And I still can remember this day. I was kind of looking at the window. I said, I can't believe it. Here we are sitting out in the car, getting ready to head home with still nothing to eat, and they're sitting around the table, and they're our friends. I was really discouraged. I got home and went into the bedroom, and I opened up my Bible to read, and when I flopped it open, there was a $10 bill laying in there. And I thought, how did that get in? I just had this Bible in church. I don't remember seeing it. It turned out that I'd laid my Bible in the back seat when we drove this fellow home, and before he got out of the car, he took a $10 bill out of his wallet and slipped it in my Bible. Well, I beat it out the front door, down to the grocery store. We bought, you know, some basic essentials. I still remember that experience, the faithfulness of God to provide needs. Well, over the years, we've kind of gone up the ladder. And so right now, Susan and I are committed to about 13.5%. So when we get paid, we take 13.5% right off of the top and put it off to the side. And I really believe that God has honored that through the years. There have been some tough times, there were some close calls, but God has always gotten us through. We've never had a bill that wasn't paid. We've gone maybe a little longer between a meal, but we haven't starved to death. You can see I'm still standing here. And there, these verses that we wrote down there speak to that issue. Proverbs 3, 9, and 10. Honor the Lord with the first fruits, not with the leftovers. Honor the Lord with the first fruits of all of your income. And on go the list of things that God will do if we honor Him in that area. Let's move on to saving. The area of saving. This is a problem for some believers. There are some that believe the Bible doesn't teach this, that it's wrong, that it's a lack of faith to save anything. I don't agree with that. Let's take a look at a couple of these verses on saving, because I believe that we're probably more in agreement that we should share, that we should give. We don't always do it, but at least intellectually we would agree that that's the proper thing to do. We all might not agree that we should be saving anything. There might be somebody here who said, I'm not sure that that's biblical to say. That's not trusting God. Let's look at a couple of these verses there across from saving. Proverbs 21, verse 20. In the house of the wise are stores of choice food and oil, but a foolish man devours all he has. The implications of the verse are that he has it, but he doesn't put any of it aside for the future. So he spends it all. He uses it all up, and then he doesn't have anything left. There's choice food and oil, but he devours all of it. He doesn't plan ahead. Proverbs 22, verse 3. Proverbs 22, verse 3, a prudent man sees danger and takes refuge, but the simple keep on going and suffer for it. The prudent man is looking down the road. He sees financial things on the horizon, but he doesn't do anything about it. He just kind of goes right on ahead, and then he walks right into an emergency. And we're going to talk in a minute about the types of things that we should be saving for. But he's not looking ahead. 1 Timothy 5:8 that you have there. It talks about that he that doesn't provide for his own family is worse than an infidel. Well, what types of things do we need to provide for family? Once again, you look down the road. As husbands, for instance, what would happen if all of a sudden I dropped dead? Where is my responsibility to provide for my children, for my wife? I have four young children. They're 12, 10, 6, and 4. Do I just say, tough luck, honey? It's all yours. Do the best you can. I would say no. 1 Timothy 5:8 tells me that I have a responsibility to provide for the needs of my family. And if I'm the bread earner and the leader in my home and all of a sudden I disappear from the scene, my wife has four young children at home, if she goes out and works, and it creates all kinds of problems. My idea would be to enable her to stay at home while the kids are young, to take care of them and be the mother that she wants to be, rather than farm them out somewhere. So I make provision for that, obviously through insurance and other types of things. So there you have at least three verses, and there are other verses on this whole subject of savings. Let me read a statement from one of the books that I'm going to recommend. Often at seminars like this, the question comes up, well, what types of things could I read that would give me some insight? If I were to recommend just one book, and I will recommend more than one, but if you were only to read one, I would suggest this one. It's just called Your Finances in Changing Times, by Larry Burkett, and it'll be laying up here on the organ along with the others. But let me read what he says about saving. A Christian should practice saving money on a regular basis. This includes those who are in debt. Even if it's only $5 a month, develop a discipline of saving. This does not mean to store up large amounts of money to the sacrifice of creditors, but one of the best habits that a couple can develop is saving a small amount on a regular basis. Everyone in our society is capable of living above the poverty, everyone in our society lives. Others believe that God frowns upon a Christian saving anything. Neither of these two is scriptural. Then he quotes Proverbs 21:20. There's precious treasure and oil in the dwelling of the wise, but a foolish man swallows it up. The common attitude presented in the Bible is to save on a regular basis, and it's important that Christians develop good habits to replace bad habits. We don't have to develop the habit of spending, do we? That just comes naturally. Nobody has any problem spending. So that's the bad habit that when money comes, the first thing we think is spend, spend. The last thing we think is save, save. Susan and I in our marriage have had an interesting dialogue for these 18 years. We kind of like to think of it that she steps on the gas pedal and I step on the brake. She likes to spend it and I like to save it. Now, in that, we complement each other because I slow her down so that she thinks more in terms of think of next week and next month. It's not just let's eat and be merry because who knows what tomorrow will bring. So let's spend it while we've got it because tomorrow surely will come. And then we don't have it. And then she helps me to become more generous and part with it rather than trying to stash it away for a rainy day. So she's a little on the liberal, generous side. I tend to be a little more conservative. She probably would say a little tight-fisted, and maybe I won't argue with that. And so we complement each other because there's a balance there. We don't want to spend it all, neither do we want to save it all. But we want to divide it between all three of these: sharing, saving, and spending. So we need to develop the discipline. What are some of the things that we could be saving for? Let me enumerate a few of them. Emergencies. Just a couple of days ago, my wife called me at work and she says, the car is really running bad. It's just limping along down Academy. I said, it's probably a spark plug. We had that problem before. Take it in, tell them to put a new plug in. So she drove it down there and she called me back. She says, it's a lot more than just a spark plug. Would you believe about $350? I said, what is it? She says, the distributor's gone and they found a couple of other things. That's an emergency. And we have made plans for emergencies like that because you never know when the car is going to break down. 2 months ago, right at Christmas time, of all the times in the world, the washing machine gave up the ghost, just died right on the floor. And with four kids, you know, she said, well, you know, I could every day, you know, 3 or 4 times a day, run down to the laundromat, back and forth, back. I said, no, we just need to go out and get another one, which we did. But so you never know when the car is going to break down, when the washing machine is going to give up, when the refrigerator is going to quit, when the kid's going to fall over and chip a tooth. Those are all kinds of emergencies. And I think the Bible teaches that we need to make contingency plans for those types of things. Then there are long-term and short-term purchases that you know you need. You put it in the category of needs. We need this or we need that. And so you can save so that 2 months from now or 3 months from now you can purchase something. It can be long-term, it can be short. A house is an example. That's maybe in the category of long-term. But let me mention three others that we often don't think about: disability, death, and retirement. You say, well, that's way down there. Don't be so sure. It could be closer than some of us think. You never know when you're going to step out in the street and something's going to happen and you can't work anymore. And we already know people who tried to make it on when the government's going to give them, and to say the least, it ain't much. So where do we come in to try to do what we can to be good stewards of what God has given us and try to put something away for down the road when debt, retirement, or disability is coming on the horizon? Those are a few reasons for saving. Okay, let's get into everybody's favorite area, spending. This is the culprit. This is the enemy that prevents us from doing the other two. Because we use it all up here, many of us, we don't have anything left over for sharing or saving. So the wife can suffer, or the husband, whatever the case might be, the kids, all the things we mentioned, emergencies and planning, the Christian work suffers because there's nothing over here, because we basically have used it all. We are the ones who did exactly what it talked about in Proverbs 21. We had it, and we devoured it. Well, let's talk a little bit about this. One of the things I wrote down here, and we've already mentioned it, but I'll say it again, is that we need to develop a standard of living and a budget that keeps you spending below your income. That really is the bottom line. Plan it and figure it out in such a way that you are consistently and constantly spending below the level of your income. Now, one of the culprits that gets us into trouble on this is the credit card. How many of you own a credit card? Just put your hand up. Okay, most of you do. Oh, the gateway to heaven, huh? All you need to do is just toss this down anywhere, and it'll get you anywhere by plane, or it can buy you anything you want. And everything's great, at least for the moment. Let me read an interesting statement here by George Fouché, and I've got a couple of his books up there. He says this: have you ever seen smoking listed as one of the leading reasons for divorce? Anybody? Have you ever read that someone committed suicide and left a note saying that smoking was the cause of his despondency? Probably not, but you may be familiar with the label that's always included with the cigarette ad, warning the use of this product may be injurious to your health. You may be using an item that contains no such warning label from the Treasurer of the United States. Look at your credit cards. Do you see anywhere on them any warnings such as these? Warning: the use of this product may cause tension in your marriage. It may make you irritable. It could lead to severe depression. It could cost you a job opportunity. It may enslave you forever. It may in the future cause a drastic change in your lifestyle. On many credit cards, however, this true but seldom noticed statement is printed on the back. Customer, by retaining or using this card, agrees to be bound. Being caught in the debt trap is in great contrast to the purposes of God. Now, I've got a credit card here, Colorado Exchange National Bank MasterCard. And on the back, I'm going to read to you what it says. By using, signing, or allowing to use this card, each cardholder named on the front side acknowledges that he or she has received, read, and is bound by the cardholder agreement. What do you think of when you think of the word bound? What pictures do you get in your mind? What? Slavery? Okay, what else do you see? Prison? Tied up. That's what I see. I see kind of my hands tied and, you know, I've been limited. Credit cards can do that for you. Let me read, I've got a thing here that I cut out of the paper back in 1982. See the pretty pictures? And I don't think you're as bad off as this guy. But let me read about him. Many people believe that happiness is rooted in possessions, and if a person like that has a tape playing in his mind, the credit card becomes a passport to happiness. There you are, sitting on the beach of Waikiki with a glass of lemonade in your hand, you know, watching the waves hit the beach. And you know how you got there? Very simple. You just took your MasterCard and threw it on the counter, and off you went into Never Never Land, only to come back and have a staggering debt staring you in the face. People do that all the time. And here's one of these guys. When Palo Alto pharmacist Walter Cavanaugh hit Time magazine, he had a total of, how many credit cards do you think he owned when they arrested him? Take a wild guess. 70,000? That would have been a lot. Well, he had quite a few. He had 890. And in his name, he had 50 others in the mail to him, and he had submitted applications for 300 more. Now, listen to this. If he would have charged to the maximum on each card that he owned, he would have racked up a debt of $9.3 million in a single month. And the fact is, he could have done it. He could have gone out on every one of those cards and used them. He would have had to work pretty fast. But he could have racked up a debt in 1 month of over $9 million just by throwing the card down and charging up to the limit on every card that he owned. Now, you know there's something wrong with our society that a person could go out and spend $9 million even if he didn't even have a dime to his name by using these plastic cards. So we can really get ourselves into trouble with them. Now, one of the ways we get into trouble is we don't make a distinction between our needs and our wants. And you'll find this on your orange sheet over to the left there. I believe that this is really one of the culprits, the main ones, that when something comes up, and I want to get it, I don't ask myself, do I really need this? Or is it a matter of fact, I simply want it? I heard a cute story about a fellow that was in a shopping store. And when she got to the checkout counter, she was fumbling for her wallet and so forth, and she took out her credit card, and it dropped to the floor. And it was wrapped in a little piece of white paper with a little note scribbled on it. So the guy behind her, you know, when he saw the card hit the floor, he reached down and he picked it up, and as he was handing her the card along with the paper, he noticed that her husband had scribbled on the white sheet of paper, "Gladys, is this purchase really necessary?" And as I thought of that, I thought, that's not a bad thing to ask myself every time I go out to buy something, especially if I'm already kind of very close to going over, or am in the habit of going over, before I lay the card down, to ask myself the question, David, is this purchase really necessary? Do I really need it, or is it just something I want because I saw it on television, or because the people up the street have it, or because my kid has been pestering me to death to buy it? Or whatever the reason might be, is this purchase really necessary? And let me close by reading a statement by Burkett on how you make that distinction. Listen carefully, because this could really save you a lot of problems. The difference between needs and wants and desires can be illustrated this way. We can see in our society today that most people need an automobile. That need can be satisfied by a used Volkswagen. That want can be satisfied by a larger car such as an Oldsmobile. And the desire may only be satisfied by a brand new Cadillac, or we might say Mercedes or BMW. A parallel would be in the food that we eat. The protein requirement of food can be satisfied by selecting good quality vegetables or hamburger. The want may be steak, and the desire may be satisfied only by eating out every night. Each of us must assess these levels according to the plan that God has for our lives. For instance, if a Christian is in financial bondage and is not able to keep his family's needs met and bills paid, he must assess whether a television set is a need, a want, or a desire. Now, this is written a few years ago. Now we must say a second television set, or a third one, or one of these humongous, you know, these great big jobbies that are, you know, 6 feet across or whatever they are nowadays. To make that distinction between needs and wants. Let me close with this statement, and then we're going to spend the rest of the time just interacting with you, answering questions, having you make observations. Show me your calendar and your checkbook, and I'll write your biography. Show me your calendar and your checkbook, and I'll write your biography. How you use your time and how you use your money will probably be the biggest single test of where you're going to wind up 5, 10, 15 years from now.